them to dedicate a good amount of time on the economy.
The economy is one of the most important aspects that both candidates need to present in a clear manner. Inflation is eating us up more every time. Immigration. Because I see that there are so many migrant families who have been here for so many years. They have an impeccable moral conduct, and still their petitions have been delayed for years. Sadly, there is a minority who are delinquents, let's call them that, in our countries. We shouldn't allow that.
Have you already made up your mind who you will be voting for?
After the first debate, I'm going to finish deciding.
Exactly. Me too.
With us now to talk more about this, former Senator Claire McCaskill, a Democrat from Missouri, and former Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, Julian Castro. Both Claire and Julian are MSNBC political analysts. Julian, I got to tell you, just having the opportunity to meet these two extraordinary ladies, they just had so much pride in being Americans, and more than 3.5 million adults who have become naturalized citizens since the 2020 presidential election are just like them, many of them already registered to vote. How crucial will these voters be?
Well, that was a wonderful piece, Lissa, and it's really heartening to see the enthusiasm and how seriously they take the ability to vote here in the United States. They're going to be crucial. These newly naturalized citizens are going to be crucial because in a number of these swing states, the margins are just so close. And the number of newly naturalized voters far exceeds, in some cases, some of these states, the margin that we saw when you're talking about Arizona, 10,000 votes, Georgia, somewhere in that neighborhood, Michigan, 150,000 votes or so. So they're important. It's also important to note that most people probably think that these are automatic Democratic votes. That's how Trump and the Republicans pitch this, but that's not true. Surveys have actually shown that this is a more split vote than most people give it credit for. That means that both parties should have an incentive to get out there and inform these voters about the candidates, to let them know what they stand for, to try and mobilize and get people out to vote. That's what I hope is going on. I think Democrats have done a much better job of this over the years, the outreach. But these voters, a lot of times, just like you heard in that piece, they're a jury, and they're waiting to make their decision.
Yeah, you know, Claire, one of the just the many things I learned from having the opportunity to speak to them was there. One lady said, after having children, the biggest gift God has ever given me is being a U.S. citizen. And with certain privileges come certain responsibilities. And I think that they feel the responsibility to participate. But the issue, for example, immigration, which is not, there's a lot of gray in it. And for these particular voters, they were like, you know, immigration is important. We need to have immigrants, but we also need to have the border secure. This is an issue that's no doubt going to come up tonight, right?
No question.
And, you know, Trump's been hammering Vice President Harris on, you know, calling her the failed borders are and all of these other issues. How do you think she has to handle this issue tonight?
Well, I think, first of all, I wish more Americans felt that way about voting.
Yeah.
I mean, it really made my heart beat a little faster.
Yeah.
And I wish.
Mine too.
I especially wish the people who are hearing the Trump campaign marginalize immigrants in a way they are, you know, amplifying stories that are totally made up about legal immigrants eating pets and things like that. You know, I think we should not take for granted, as my colleague pointed out, that these immigrants are all going to be Democratic voters. I think what she has to do, she has to point out that this administration has, in fact, done whatever they can do by executive order, and the border crossings are dramatically down to a level that we haven't seen in years.
After a record number came in.
And then secondly, she's got to continue to point out that Donald Trump cared more about his reelection than he cared about the immigration problem at the border. He wanted to not solve the problem because it didn't help him politically. The Republicans all know that. My friends in the Senate that are Republican have admitted as much to me.
You mean the border bill, for example?
The border bill. He single-handedly shut down that bill.
He did it publicly, almost.
And the Border Patrol endorsed it. So if the Border Patrol is endorsing a bill that will help the problem at the border, and a guy running for president says don't pass it, that's all you need to know about who he's looking after.
Yeah, I mean, Julian, and I know, you know, you were so, I mean, you're in so many ways a visionary, you know, when in the last presidential debates, you know, you mentioned the issue of what is, one thing is la palabra, otra cosa es el hecho. One thing is the word, the other thing is the acts that you carry out. And so I'm just wondering, Julian, what is it that the vice president could do to help define herself, maybe differently, certainly differently from former President Trump, but also maybe differently from the Biden administration?
Yeah, and I think that she's been doing that well, Jose. I mean, the polling shows that she's actually closed the gap with Trump on this issue of immigration in terms of the confidence that voters have that each candidate will address this issue effectively. I think what she needs to do is go out there and do two things. First, how is she going to ensure that we have a good, secure border, that there's order at the border? I think folks across the political spectrum are interested in that. But she also has an opportunity to differentiate herself from Trump and remind people about the cruelty of his administration, the family separation, the way that he's demonized immigrants, the really white nationalist vision that he's espoused. Sure, he has a base that craves that. That's their red meat. But I think the majority of the Americans, no matter their background, they don't go along with that. So she can achieve both of those things. Policy-wise, that means the investments that we're going to make in terms of order at the border. And then how are you going to get a pathway to citizenship for those who have been here, Dreamers and others, for years and years and are positively contributing to America's economy and our neighbors, our coworkers, our friends out there? I think she can do both of those things effectively. So far in the campaign, they have. And then as Senator McCaskill said, look, she's got the goods on Trump. He sabotaged best opportunity in years to actually get an immigration bill done that would have helped fix the problem. She needs to remind voters very forthrightly about that at every opportunity. That's what, unfortunately, I think President Biden was not able to do on this and a number of other issues in July, but she's going to be able to do tonight, I think.
Yeah, and words matter, as Julian was saying. Claire, Trump was talking about mass deportations over the weekend when he made this comment. Take a listen to it.
In Colorado, they're so brazen, they're taking over sections of the state. And, you know, getting them out will be a bloody story. Should have never been allowed to come into our country. Nobody checked them. Nobody checked. Were they criminals? Were they from jails?
This is a narrative, Clara, that the former president has been, as you mentioned, weaving, not just recently, but for years, but more intensely in the last couple of weeks and months. What is he trying to say here?
Well, he is running a campaign of grievance, and he is appealing just to his base. And unfortunately, they don't want to hear that the lack of jobs might be because of the microchip. They would rather blame someone, and he wants to blame immigrants. He wants to blame Mexicans or Muslims or whoever it is that looks different than you do or might worship differently than you do. It is really un-American. It is not what this country is. And I hope that every new citizen in America listens to how he has talked about immigrants generally. Yes, we do not need people breaking the law to come to this country. And I know most legal immigrants and most people who have achieved legal status agree with that. But that doesn't mean you have the right to demonize an entire important part of the American fabric. And I hope that that pushes those undecided voters like the woman that you interviewed over to Kamala Harris's side of the equation.
Thank you for listening.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, for many people and for much media, the idea of racial discrimination in housing invokes an image of individual landlords refusing to rent or sell homes to black and brown people. But that understanding is so incomplete as to be harmful. A new book doesn't just illuminate the thicket of effects of systemic racism as it affects where people live. It reframes the understanding of the role of housing, connecting housing injustice with health inequities and wealth disparities, as well as lifting up work that connects those mutually constitutive elements of what the author calls an unjust, destructive, and even deadly racial order. George Lipsitz is research professor emeritus of Black Studies and Sociology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He's author of The Possessive Investment in Whiteness and How Racism Takes Place, among other titles. He'll join us to talk about his new book, The Danger Zone is Everywhere: How Housing Discrimination Harms Health and Steals Wealth. That's coming up, but first, a quick look back at some recent press. On October 1st, port workers across the eastern U.S. began a strike that lasted 3 days. It was just the latest in a series of confrontations between workers and bosses in North America. But as Paul Hedreen writes for Fair.org, corporate reporters never seem to get better at explaining these fights. That's to say, they show how corporate supersedes reporting at nearly every turn. Here, workers' main demands were pay increases and assurances that automation wouldn't replace them. But strikes in general have the aim of demonstrating the importance of workers by showing the impact of depriving the economy of their labor. The International Longshoremen's Association gained an initial victory in securing a 62% wage increase over 6 years for its workers. Other issues like automation will continue to be negotiated. But it seems like the more a strike has its intended effect of affecting the economy, the harder elite media work to smear workers as selfish and destructive. Look first at who they quote. When's the last time you saw a press report on some high finance or business dealing that included a comment from a union leader or a rank-and-file worker? Yet when dock workers initiate a labor action, it seems the first call a reporter makes is to a Manhattan office tower. Stifel is an investment bank that manages $444 billion worth of assets, perhaps best known for tricking Wisconsin school districts into losing $200 million in bum mortgage investments ahead of the 2008 financial crisis. But lately, the phones at the bank's offices are overwhelmed with reporters seeking comment on the port strike. Analysts at Stifel have been quoted 4 times in the Washington Post and New York Times. Union leaders weren't silenced. Since September 24th, 4 ILA leaders have been quoted by the New York Times. That would, though, be 2 fewer than the 6 wine importers the Times has quoted in strike coverage. Coverage in general noted how some union members make hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, without noting that the exceptional packages they're referencing are outside of the contract being negotiated. But it does work as a hand wave to suggest to readers that people who the Times points out are, quote, without a college degree, close quote, are getting rich loading freight. The starting wage for a dock worker is $20 an hour. The top wage after 6 years under the current contract is $39. So a 40-hour-a-week salary would get a senior worker just about $80,000. To earn in the hundreds of thousands, overtime is clearly needed. But for the Times, that's not a fact, but an allegation. Dock workers, quote, say they have to put in long work weeks to earn that much, close quote. On the rare occasion when shippers' historically high profits are mentioned, they're also not presented as fact often, but as something that is argued by workers, as the Washington Post put it. So that Economist headline, "Boom times are back for container shipping," well, just avert your eyes and get back to seeing workers as greedy and unreasonable. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. Some 10 years ago, food delivery service Fresh Direct got more than $100 million of incentives to place a warehouse in a populated, poor, largely people of color community in the South Bronx to bring heavy diesel truck traffic to asthma-inflicted neighborhoods already affected by waste treatment plants and high-traffic highways. Groups like South Bronx Unite, like Good Jobs New York, opposed these further health harms to the community, as well as the notion that a handful of insecure, poorly waged jobs could serve as compensation. South Bronx Unite's Michael Johnson said, "Of course we want jobs, but we should not have to choose between having a job and having clean air. If you can't breathe, you can't work." Now we understand that folks are working to reclaim pieces of the affected community called the Harlem River Yard, including allowing access to the Harlem River waterfront access that's been cut off to the public for a long time. That's just one of thousands of stories that exemplify the ways that racism inflects all kinds of decisions, policies, laws that we're told are, nowadays anyway, indifferent to race. That's a mistaken notion that hobbles our ability to respond effectively to the interconnected harms of white supremacy and myriad U.S. institutions that, to be real, harm everyone and not just black and brown people. George Lipsitz is research professor emeritus of black studies and sociology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He's author of many books, The Possessive Investment in Whiteness and How Racism Takes Place Among Them. His most recent book that we're here to talk about is called The Danger Zone is Everywhere: How Housing Discrimination Harms Health and Steals Wealth. It's out now from University of California Press. I will note that George was for years the chair of the board of the African American Policy Forum, where I also serve as a board member. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, George Lipsitz.
Thank you. So glad to be here.
Your new book addresses the interconnectedness of laws, policies, and practices around housing that, without needing to be overtly coordinated, reinforce one another to produce and reproduce discriminatory outcomes. So we could really pull an opening thread anywhere here. But when we talk about housing discrimination, I know that many folks' minds go to redlining, where officially sanctioned protocols meant black families just couldn't buy homes in certain neighborhoods. And the thinking is, while certainly that had lasting impacts, it was years ago and it's been legally remediated by now. So while the book talks importantly about the inadequacies of the ways that harms have been diagnosed and responded to, maybe we could just start with a breakdown of some of the multiple forms of discrimination in housing that takes. Why is it that housing is at the center of the spider web of so many other discriminatory dangers?
When I say the danger zone is everywhere, housing discrimination raises in people's minds a direct act of discrimination, refusal to rent or sell to a person of a targeted race, or the long effects of redlining. And these are still in effect, and they have an enormous impact on people's life chances and opportunities. But a lot of housing discrimination is enacted through things that don't overtly appear to be about race and may not even directly appear to be about housing. I talk in the book about the ways in which lowball home value appraisals, property owned by black people, hurt their ability to sell and refinance. And those same houses have artificially high property tax appraisals, which makes them pay a disproportionate share of taxation, makes them subject to tax lien foreclosures and auctions, which have been a massive transfer of wealth, especially in the last 10 years. housing discrimination puts people from aggrieved groups in what Tricia Rose calls proximity to toxicity, close to incinerators, toxic waste dumps, diesel fuels, pesticides. It also is enacted through a tax system that functions as an engine of racial inequality, property tax relief in some cities for homeowners has meant that renters, and the city of Ferguson in Missouri is an example of this, that renters are harassed by predatory policing that imposes arbitrary fines, fees, and debts on them as a way to raise municipal revenue to make up for the subsidies that are given to people who've been able to profit from housing discrimination. And there's also mass incarceration is a disabling process, a disease-spreading practice. It affects people's nervous systems and anxiety, produces hypertension. And even something like insurance, which appears to be race neutral because it's determined by algorithms, the algorithms are created by humans and they basically make the success of past discrimination an excuse for continuing and extending it by equating Black people with risk. I'll give an example. One of the things that affects your credit score is the kind of loan that you got. And so if you got a subprime loan, even if you qualified for a prime loan, you're considered to be a credit risk, but there was nothing wrong with your behavior. It was the discrimination of the loan that was given to you. So I say that the danger zone is everywhere, that housing discrimination harms health and steals wealth. And as you said, it not only harms its direct victims, it also squanders the skills and abilities of the people whose lives are shortened because of it, misallocates resources, and it basically increases costs of insurance and healthcare policing for everyone.
Well, let's spell just a couple of things out. First, about health. Housing discrimination harming health is not limited to polluters, like I talked about Fresh Direct, about polluters being placed in aggrieved communities. The impact of housing policy on health, there's a number of other pieces to that, yes.
You can be in an area that has no medical services. You can be in an area, we found that areas that have concentrated poverty and concentrated populations of people who can't move elsewhere because of housing discrimination have more pedestrian accidents. The street lighting is worse. People who are renters in this age of incredible shortages of housing, and part of that is because of massive buy-up of homes by private equity firms, can't really bargain with their landlords. You know, if your landlord is somebody you know, that's one thing. If it's a private equity company that has 20 or 30,000 residences, you may not even be able to find out the identity of that landlord.
Right.
And then it becomes very difficult to, say, repair the furnace, make sure that the electricity is safe, make sure that the water is okay, deal with the pests and rodents that are in this place. So it creates health hazards inside the houses. It creates hazards outside the houses. Also, people who live in places where a lot of houses have been torn down, especially in a city like Detroit, where private equity firms have been buying them up and tearing them down, that produces dust, which young children bring in to their homes from playing in the street. And it increases their likelihood of asthma and many other deadly diseases. Farm workers constantly live in housing that is close to pesticides, close to pollution, but they also suffer from being in places that are food deserts where you can't get nutritious food, or food swamps where you can only get unnutritious food. And they also suffer from the lack of medical insurance. Some of that caused by the high cost of housing, it means that rather than be evicted from their homes, they'll forego necessary medicines and remedies that they would otherwise buy.
I don't believe that people understand the interconnectedness of this. And I think that's part of the way that we talk about things. Healthcare problems are one thing. Housing problems are another thing. And if you disconnect those things, then you don't get what's happening. And that's exactly what I think this book is getting at is the way that these things are immediately connected. They have everything to do with one another. For example, stealing wealth, which is the other part of the title. People think owning a home is central to the American dream. And it's not just because it's because you have a roof over their head. It's because you have hereditary wealth. You now own a thing that you can transfer to your children. And that has everything to do with your sense of confidence of your life and your ability to provide for folks and your absence from your distance from precarity. All of these things are connected, which I think the book is trying to get at.
You know, certainly these impediments to being able to inherit assets that appreciate in value can be passed down across generations. It's a massive transfer of wealth and a tremendous injury that goes across generations. But it's also a matter of housing and health are talked about separately, but they're also talked about separately from education, from incarceration, right, from transportation. And yet they're mutually constitutive. Even within some of these fields, when people are trained in law, they focus on the tort model of injury, and this teaches them that discrimination has to be individual, intentional, interpersonal, and that it's an aberrant practice in an otherwise fair market. But actually, this has nothing to do with the way housing discrimination works most of the time.
Right.
Although there are 4 million instances of intentional, individual, interpersonal injuries every year. But housing discrimination is also collective, cumulative, continuing. It produces inequalities that can't be remedied one at a time. And similarly with health, that we have an individualized model of health that imagines that people's genetics and their whether they exercise and whether they eat healthy food is the key thing in determining their health. But there are also collective issues like sewage management, garbage collection, coal-burning furnaces and incinerators, lead in paint and gasoline. All of these things have an impact on health, and they not only need to be studied together, but that people involved in fair housing law have to think about health justice. People who are dispensing medical care need to think about the neighborhoods that their patients come from and return to, and the impact that those neighborhoods have on their health and on the relations between parents and children and on even whether people are considered valued in the society. You live in a place that tells you you're everybody's lowest priority. You may not have a reason to want to be healthy. And then if you add to that the lack of physicians, the high cost of health care, the way in which pharmaceutical companies and insurance companies jack up the cost of health care, you're basically engaged in a calculated cruelty in the organized abandonment of large numbers of people. And this harm is most egregious on children because they can't defend themselves, because their physical systems are less able to deal with health menaces. And so, you know, we're basically squandering a large part of the next generation in a country that is increasingly made up of people who are not white. And we're basically setting those children up for failure. It's like a time bomb that will go off in the future. And there's a lot of foreseeable harm that could be prevented. A key theory of pediatric care is that you don't just remedy illnesses after they happen. You foresee them in advance and prevent them from happening. We could do that with the environment. We could do that with nutrition. We could do that with giving people a safe, affordable living environment. But we don't do it because there's so much money to be made from injustice.
I do want to put folks onto the book, The Danger Zone is Everywhere, because there's no way that we can address all of this in the time that we have. But I want to say the book is enlightening about many things. And one of them is the importance of just the way that we look at the way we see societal inequities and the way we talk about them. And what you're saying is we're talking about rejecting this approach that addresses individuals as though they were divorced from community. We're looking at individual actions by individual landlords and not looking at systems. And that's part of the problem.
And this is what the law assumes, that an injury interrupts an otherwise just situation. You sue the individual perpetrator. You're then made whole and you go back to being fine. But what if you're not fine to begin with? What if there isn't one individual perpetrator? What if it's a conjuncture of obstacles in your way? Once you punish that one corporation, they declare bankruptcy and they open up the next day with a different name.
Right.
And once the injured person wins a fair housing settlement, they go back into an innately unfair housing market where they are disadvantaged in getting loans, they're disadvantaged in getting insurance, they're disadvantaged in their relations with the police, they're disadvantaged in relation to the schools that their children are able to go to. So we need to have this multi-axis problems need multi-axis and intersectional solutions, and that means we need to work together. It means that there's a limit what any one of us can do as an individual to have good health or housing for ourselves, much less for the whole society. And that's why I try to stress in the book the emerging active and engaged public sphere constituency for good health and fair housing, that fair housing councils throughout the country and advocates and attorneys who take on those cases, public health collectives, environmental justice organizing, community gardens, food co-ops, arts-based health projects like Building Healthy Communities in Boyle Heights, a whole series of community land trusts where people pool resources to take speculation out of the market. And so people are mobilizing precisely because they realize that as an individual, there's very little you can do. In courtroom, the boardroom, or the banker's office, there are limits to what can be done. Now, there should be justice in all of those places, and individuals are entitled to good health, good housing, to the full benefits of civil rights law. But we also need to have an understanding that race itself is a political, not a biological category, that it functions because people see things a certain way. Racism persists because people believe that people are members of different races. And we need to see racism as structural, systemic, collective. And good health and good housing can't just be left to be private commodities to be purchased. They're public resources, and they need to be protected by the public and nurtured and sustained.
Well, I'll only ask you one final question about news media, because we do see coverage sometimes about the difficulties of homelessness or the problems of companies like Blackstone buying up homes. We see coverage. It's just that it's not connecting the dots. The story about why people are homeless is not connected to the story about venture capitalists buying up homes. It's not connected. And so to me, it's what I call narrating the nightmare. Something terrible is happening. And look at these harmed people. But somehow we can't name who's behind it or how it could be stopped. But media say, you can't say we're not acknowledging it, because look at this one story where we said how harmful it is. And it drives me up a wall, because I know that reporters aren't stupid, and I know that they're not incapable of thinking systemically. I know they don't think structural problems are boring, and I know that they don't understand that regular people could grasp them. So I guess what I'm saying is that corporate news media suffer from some of the same ailments that you are diagnosing in healthcare and housing, and could benefit from some of the same medicine, I guess.
Yeah, and some of this has to do with the demographics of the news media industry, which is similar to the demographics of the legal profession and the medical profession, that there aren't enough people who have experienced discrimination directly, but it's also that a good plot has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And so last year, there were a number of stories about bias in home appraisal, in which Black families got a low appraisal for their home, and they then got a white friend to sit in for them, and they took down the Jacob Lawrence paintings and the Toni Morrison books.
Mm-hmm.
And when it appeared that the home was owned by a white person, it was as much as $500,000 more. I'm glad they covered this, and this is a good story. And fair housing groups have sued about appraisal discrimination, and the National Fair Housing Alliance has a whole campaign about it. But nobody connected those instances to the systemic problems in the appraisal industry, which Elizabeth Corver Glenn has written about in her book, Rates Brokers. They haven't related that to the low home value appraisals are connected to high property tax appraisals, as Andrew Carl points out in his great book, The Black Tax. So the information is out there, but it's just that they end the story too soon and they assume things are going to be all right. Lorraine Hansberry wrote this play called Raisin in the Sun, which is about a black family moving into a white neighborhood. And at the end of the play, the black people are in the neighborhood and critics said, oh, this is a happy ending. And Lorraine Hansberry said, well, if you think that's a happy ending, where do they wake up the next morning and have bricks and rocks thrown at their house and the neighbors don't talk to them and the police harass them? And so you can't end the story too soon. We have to think about all these interconnections.
Absolutely. And we could and will continue this conversation much further. But I just want to tell folks that we've been speaking with George Lipsitz. He's research professor emeritus of Black Studies and Sociology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And the book we're talking about is called The Danger Zone is Everywhere. And it's available now from University of California Press. George Lipsitz, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you, Janine. I really appreciate the conversation.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can get more information on our website, FAIR.org. The show's engineered by Riley Baer. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
We didn't need the space. Made it so you could miss me. You only drifted away. Faded to gray with the city. I don't know why I always do this. Get no reply, I keep on losing. I'll try to call, but it's just useless. Again and again, my heart keeps bruising. Baby, you don't miss you, you're so. for so long, you notice how it's starting to show.